West Virginia, oh my home. West Virginia's where I belong. In the dead of the night, in the still, in the quiet, I slip away like a bird in flight back to those hills, the place that I call home. It's been years now since I left there, and this city life's about got the best of me. I can't remember why I left so free, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to see, but I can sure remember where I come from.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to hear a conversation I had with country music legend Hazel Dickens. She was born in West Virginia in the 1930s and moved here to Baltimore as a teenager in the 1950s in search of work in our city's factories. She brought with her the Appalachian music tradition she grew up with and started playing country, folk, and bluegrass with other musicians here and then around the country. She started a musical career that exists to this day. Here's part of my interview with Hazel Dickens. We discussed the meaning of her music, the direction her life has taken, her Appalachian heritage, and much, much more. You spent a good piece of your life, the last 40 years, being really involved in what you believe in, whether it's rights of coal miners, Appalachia, people's rights, people's struggles.
It was just something that was there, that was real, and almost all of my brothers go in the mines, and cousins and uncles, and my father hauled, went up in the woods and cut timber and hauled timber to prop up the roofs of the mines. Back then they used, the more primitive methods.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very involved with that when I grew up. And so it just kind of stayed with me. And also it was much more, it was easier to write about something that you knew about when I started writing. And I don't know why somebody mentioned that. A musicologist actually was talking to me when he said, "It's funny that you stayed with that and you didn't branch out and go like Nashville or you know something else." And I said, "Well, part of it was probably for economical reasons, because I didn't have to pay anything to learn it. I already knew it." And I grew up with it, so I saved a lot of money there. but mostly it was because that's where my heart was. I love the music.
You've always done that. It seems to me the heart of your life has always been that you never played just to go out and make some money. You played from the heart.
I try to stay true to the music. Yeah, and it's just the only thing that really matters. You know, because if you're going to take it and water it down and make something else out of it. A lot of people who play in Nashville, not that I'm trying to trash Nashville, I have a lot of friends there.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll stick country when people are interviewing them or something. But really, they aren't country. You know, they aren't country at all. And it's all rock and folk rock, and if it's generally, there's no bluegrass, and bluegrass is one of the core, you know, musics that we came from. That and jazz and, you know, blues. that type of music is right from the Appalachian area. And started out being old time, and very very old primitive, an old person sitting around picking a banjo on his front porch, with no other instruments, but they could make a world of music.
Mm-hmm.
Just with that one, and then they started maybe the string bands or the maybe accompaniment to what they were already singing unaccompanied.
And you sang, and of course the church has something to do with that too, right? I mean, a lot of mm-hmm. the music came right out of the church.
Yes, I sang some in the Primitive Baptist Church, but there was never, people keep saying stuff like she was in a choir. We didn't have choirs. You know, it wasn't that fancy.
You just sang.
Yeah, it was very, very old and very primitive. And everyone sang unaccompanied. There were no instruments allowed in the church. So everyone, it was an amazing sound to have a whole church full of people singing a cappella.
It's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
It is gorgeous.
Amazing. I've never heard any sound like it. And I've always liked it.
I mean, in some ways, when you think about the work that you do, the work that you've done, the music that you preserved and sang and shared with all of us for these last 40-odd years, I mean, it really is, you and a few others are really that connection to the heart of the music that came out of Appalachia. I mean, you're connected to your parents and grandparents in ways that, mm-hmm. you know, it's a really important thing.
It is, because it's dying out. You know, fortunately, there are a lot of young people that have found it, and what they will do with it, I don't know, because generally what I find is there's nobody does it like the old fogies did, like the older people did. You just can't. I mean, who could replace Doc Watson?
Nobody.
And Doc Boggs, and you know, all of those older people, Roscoe Holcomb. There's nobody would even put themselves out on a limb like that. You know, they want to do something that's more acceptable. And, it's very hard, and was very hard, to survive in a climate like that. But there are lots and lots and lots of people that still... And if you don't believe it, just get out and roam around, and you'll see the parks where they have the music. You'll see motorhome after motorhome that will be parked on these lots. And a lot of them will bring their families. And it's like a family-oriented music. And it's always been kind of like that. And I think that's the reason it survived. Was because of the support it got from families. I think it will always be there.
It will always be there. I mean, because mm-hmm. we've preserved the sound, too. I mean, that's that,
yes.
You know, I mean, when everybody passes away, whenever that happens, I mean, the sound will still be there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about...
A lot of it's been recorded.
Right.
The Library of Congress and the Smithsonian's got loads and loads and loads of stuff that'll be there forever.
In your life singing with people like Alice Gerard and others, I mean, it was a man's world, and you all really did stand up for women back then when women were just like appendages in this bluegrass world.
I think we were probably some of the first women to start recording music that was, they call it feminist music, but we didn't consider ourselves feminists
mm-hmm.
at all. In fact, we were far from it. You know, we were mostly old-time and just hung around people like that. And we were not out, you know, walking picket lines, although later I did get into that
mm-hmm.
a little bit and would support that. But at that time when we were coming up with those songs, when I wrote Don't Put Her Down, You Help Put Her There.
Right.
I was
song.
Almost afraid to sing it.
Why?
You know, because of the atmosphere and this one guy, men got offended by it. And this one, he's a big star now, I won't call his name, but he heard it at a festival. I forget where it was. It might have been Vancouver. It might have been Winnipeg. I have a feeling it was probably Vancouver. And he just said, who wrote that song? And he was all offended by it. And then in later years, he came to respect everything that I did and wanted to do some of the music. And then Bob Dylan happened to be there. He came to see the new Lost City Ramblers. and he was a big fan of New York City Ramblers.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked who I was. He was. It had a totally different effect on him. Isn't that amazing?
That is interesting. You know,
I was closer to was offended by it, but somebody like that who I didn't know, and then John Cohen introduced me and
to Bob Dylan.
To him, and he ended up getting a song from off of the album that Alice and I did called "The Two Soldiers," and he gave us credit for it. But we actually got it from the New York City Ramblers ourselves. So.
Hmm.
We didn't get out there and actually do the archives and find it. We took it from them.
So. I mean, in all that, though, you were also, I mean, all these great women folk singers and country singers, they really pay homage to you as someone that they learn from and inspire them along the way.
A lot of them do, yes, and I didn't quite understand that. Because it's sort of different than what we were trying to do. We were just, I just said, well, let's just write what comes to mind and some stuff that's been on our mind. Or what you see that you get disturbed by or things that make an impression on you. Or, you know, because that's the only thing you have, you know, unless you make up stuff. You know, like Silverstein, he was a wordsmith, and he could write stuff like stuff Loretta Lynn sang, you know, like "One's on the Way" or
mm-hmm.
something like that. And I never could do that. People have asked me to come and write with them, and I mean people who have written for people like Alison Krauss, and maybe Tom T. Hall's wife, Dixie, or just different people. But I never can do it like that. I mean, if somebody, they would say, let's write today. And I said, what are you going to write about? Oh, we don't know. We'll make some pasta and have some pasta, and we'll mill around the kitchen. And, you know, we'll... I said, my God, you got to have something to write about if you sit down to write. You know? And I never did get involved in it because I was afraid that I would embarrass myself, that I'd come up empty-handed, empty-brained. And I would go, if I got a line came to me or a verse came to me, I would try to write it down. And then eventually I realized that I had to do better than that because I would not remember what the melody was. So I got a little tape machine, and if it seemed like it was going anywhere, I would put it on the tape machine.
And then write it down later?
Yeah, even if it was just maybe a line or two or a verse. And I wrote a song recently like that. And I actually went ahead and recorded it. And... it came to me when I was making lunch.
Uh-huh.
And it was about this friend of mine who, and her husband, who are in the music business. And she and I would talk. And we'd get on the phone and talk. And we'd kind of cry on each other's shoulders, so to speak. We didn't really, but we would, and talk about how hard it was, you know, to be women in the music and get men to listen to us. Because a lot of the producers, when you showed up with your male band, they talked to your male band.
Instead of talking to you.
Mm. Or they'd kind of look over you to them. And so we would talk about how hard it was to keep musicians. And she was telling me about some of the trouble she'd had with this one. And I said, oh, I know. We're used to giving therapy all the time. We have to do that. I said, well, I had to do that on the tour. Well, I'd take one in one room and my tour director would take one in the other room. And we'd give them therapy and straighten them out and do the show. And so I said, we're used to that. And she said, yes, but it gets hard. So I said, well, come on into town and we'll go see Down from the Mountain. And we'll talk to Patty Loveless and some of those people. That'll cheer you up. So she came into town, and we had some Chinese and went to see the Down from the Mountain. And when I got home the next day, I got up, and that song came to me right out of the blue. And I was thinking about them, them meaning she and her husband, and what they had gone through and how supportive he was of her. And I told her how lucky she was to have somebody that was that good to her and that supportive all the way down the line, played in her band too. And I just sat down and wrote a song about it, and it's called My Heart's Own Love. And the tune came to me, and the words came to me.
The whole journey that you took from Appalachia to Baltimore and then to the rest of the world, I mean, this is it's an important story you have to tell in terms of your struggle, the struggle of working people, the struggle of women, fighting for social justice, using your songs to lighten people's lives, but also to talk about people's struggles. I mean, you balanced all those things together.
It's a deep subject.
Yeah.
It's a lot to consider, and most people, they do not. They have it in their mind when things are done to them, you know, when they want to rise up and say, you can't do that to me. But they'll never write about it, you know. Like when I wrote Working Girl Blues, I was actually at work when I started that song.
Uh-huh.
And I turned the inventory sheet over. He's making us do inventory. And I got so bored because I wanted to be out of there and I wanted to be singing. And I just turned it over and started writing the Working Girl Blues. And then I sang it for the girls that was working with me. They were under me at that time, though. I had gotten to be assistant manager and then manager. And they'd say, Hazel, sing Working Girl Blues. So I'd sing it for them. And then when I got to doing shows and they started coming to them, they'd sit on the front row and yell out, sing Working Girl Blues.
Hey, got the early Monday morning working blues.
That was my conversation with country music legend Hazel Dickens. We're going to leave you with Working Girl Blues, sung by Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard.
Oh, well, the weekend was too short, but I can't choose. When the Lord made the working girl, he made the blues. Well, I'm tired of working my life away and giving somebody else all of my pay while they get rich on the profits that I lose and leaving me here with the working girl blues. I the other day, working girl blues, and I can't even afford a new pair of shoes. But I wonder, will my hair be all turned gray before he turns that dollar loose and I get my due and lose a little bit of these working girl blues? I'm
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.